Good morning, everyone. Now you can hear me. Welcome. We're going to get started. We're running about 5 to 7 minutes behind, so just so you know, from a timing standpoint, that's where we are. We are going to go the full hour, though. I'm Allie Lavalley. I'm the Director of Global Procurement at Converse, and I lead our Women of Converse organization. I'll be your MC today. Thank you. I'm absolutely thrilled to be here to support the advancement of women leaders and to support this fabulous community. I'm also honored to be here because I believe that one of my life purposes is to help women reach their potential and reach their greatness. So I'm grateful to be a part of this conference to further that mission. I'm also really thrilled that we have 50 women from Converse here today. Woohoo! As part of our inaugural sponsorship of the Massachusetts Conference for Women. We at Converse are a proud partner of the Massachusetts Conference for Women. The conference is an action-packed day full of inspiration, tools, and insights, and it also provides fabulous networking opportunities. The Massachusetts Conference for Women is committed to empowering each of you and to inspiring you each to make your mark in your work, in your careers, and in your communities. Thank you for participating in today's breakout session, Self-Advocate, Stand Up, and Negotiate for What You Want. As a procurement professional, this topic is near and dear to my heart. We have an amazing hour in store for you. Now I'm excited to introduce Selena Rizvani. Please put your hands together for Selena. Selena teaches women at all levels to negotiate like a boss. She consults employers to make work truly work for women by illuminating the working women's experience. She's the author of 2 leadership books, Push Back, How Smart Women Ask and Stand Up for What They Want, which garnered an Axiom Book Award, and The Next Generation of Women Leaders. Selena addresses thousands of professional women each year. She's been featured in the LA Times, Oprah.com, TodayShow.com, and NPR. She wrote an award-winning column for the Washington Post and currently serves as a columnist for Forbes. Selena is a VP at Be Leaderly, a leadership development solutions firm. She's based out of Philadelphia, where she lives with her husband, Jeff, and her boy-girl twins. Please join me in welcoming Selena.
Thank you, Allie, and good morning to all of you. How are you?
Great.
Good, good. Before we dive in here, I want to take a minute and acknowledge you. You all could be 100 other places today, easily, but you're here, investing in yourselves. And I'm a big believer that the best return on investment you'll ever get is the one you make in yourself. So to really properly acknowledge that, can you do me a favor and put your right arm up really high? Go ahead and pat yourself on the back. I have been the recipient of an incredible education. I'm not talking about college degrees or, you know, specialty learning under some Yoda. I have had the chance to pull up a chair and interview dozens of women executives at the top of the top, the C-suite, to ask them how one skill set has informed their role, their move upward. This idea of self-advocacy and negotiating. That research formed the basis of my book, Pushback, and the columns I write. And I'd like to share, as we get ready for this great discussion today, some of the highlights from that research, 4 of them with you, that have really made an indelible mark on me. First, I asked one quantitative question of these many women leaders, from the CEO of Charles Schwab to the CEO of the Washington Post. I had to get one nerdy question in there. And I asked a simple one. What percentage of a woman's career success is made up by her ability to negotiate? What do you think I heard? You can shout it in your best outdoor voice. 90, 50, 80, 70, yeah, 60. When I averaged all the responses, 60, almost two-thirds of your career success hinging on this skill. So while I heard about things like people management being important and technical skills being sharp and financial acumen, this ability to make a proposal, to make an ask, and back yourself ranked higher. So I think a takeaway here is this is not a nice-to-have skill. This is a must-have skill as you navigate your paths. Two, C-level women, I learned, don't wait for the recognition pixie to come down and hand them an invitation to negotiate. You know, now's the time, or here's the proper issue to negotiate. I was dazzled by the fact that they have an expansive view of what's negotiable. Everything from the maternity leave that they took, to the Plum project that's just come in the door, to the leadership role on the Plum project that just came in the door, the competitive great pay, the unrealistic deadline that was unmeetable. You know, my favorite of all, being offered career path A or B and negotiating for the non-existent option C. Right? So many of these women did that. You all negotiate every day. You know, you already do this, and clearly women who've made it to the top are doing it constantly. You have to be willing to engage. Three, I had a mistaken idea going into these interviews that these women had this perfect golden path to the top. Like they had probably never struggled a moment in their lives, been A-plus students, captain of the debate team in fourth grade, all of that. And that's not what they said. You know, yeah, they had accolades. They have incredible recognition they deserve. But so many of them said, you know what I attribute to getting here? I'm more persistent than most. When they told me I wasn't chief material, I wasn't president material, I went back and I asked five more times, how about now? How about under these conditions? How about with that timing? So tenacity pays. That persistence pays. The fourth thing, the last thing I want to share with you is that you train other people how to see you. And I want to take a little left turn for a minute from the hard research to use a different example. How many of you have ever had a puppy? Raise your hand. Okay, good amount. And was that puppy ever naughty? Raise your hand. Yeah. Sometimes there's more hands with that second question, which is kind of funny. But, right. If you've ever seen the show The Dog Whisperer, you know that Caesar Milan goes into these homes, right? And there's these naughty, wild, unwieldy dogs. And in a matter of days, he transforms them into these sweet, behaving, compliant pups. Amazing. If you watch any trainer or that show, who is he really training? The owners, right? And the point I'd like to make here is in the same way as those humans, those owners, you are training people how to see you. When you negotiate for something better, when you don't negotiate and you settle for something suboptimal, you're training people how to assess your value, your worth, your time, right? Make sure you like what you're teaching them. Make sure you like how you're training them and what that frame is. To recap, the 60% equation, negotiating is a big part of your work life in terms of advancing. Two, not waiting for that recognition pixie. but having a big, expansive view of what's negotiable. 3, being persistent and tenacious. And 4, training others how to see you. Do you want to hear more about negotiating?
Yes.
Great, so do I. And we have a wicked awesome panel right here for you today. I've been dying to say that my whole life, and I'm in Boston. So this is my moment. This is my moment. Thank you for giving it to me. We are going to walk through a club sandwich of negotiation topics today with this great panel. And I just want to touch on what those are. Negotiation mindset. How do you prepare mentally before you ever walk in the room? And how does that drive your outcomes? 2, tactics. You know, what are those behaviors, those micro behaviors or maybe big behaviors that can help you navigate the conversation on game day confidently? 3, what's a key takeaway this group wants to really impress upon you? They're going to share that one biggie for you at the end. And then 4th, we're going to leave time for your questions. We want to hear from you, the audience. So I'm so lucky to be up here with these 3. And I'm going to start by introducing Jennifer Mead next to me. She is a VP of Sales and Commercial Excellence for the Breast and Skeletal Health Division at Hologic. She works with division leadership to create and execute customer engagement strategies to drive sustained, profitable growth, and get this, to bring life-saving technologies to the market. Awesome. She started her career in finance, and she's held a variety of roles in sales and commercial excellence at Hologic and elsewhere. Welcome, Jennifer.
Thank you.
Next up, lovely Lisa Brady is the Director of Supply Chain Sustainability at Cisco. She leads systems in sustainability, risk, compliance, and supplier diversity. That's all. That's huge. She joined Cisco from Dell EMC, where she led the supply chain sustainability integration for the merger of EMC and Dell. In her 16 years at EMC, she drove cross-functional change as a leader and built a new operations team in supply chain. Welcome, Lisa. And last but not least, Chris Voss, we're so happy to have you. He is a negotiation expert, a CEO of the Black Swan Group, and author of the national bestseller, Never Split the Difference, Negotiating as If Your Life Depended on It. It's in the bookstore. If you haven't seen it, check it out. It was named one of the 7 best books on negotiating. Drawing on his experience in high-stakes negotiations, he specializes in solving business communication problems using hostage negotiation strategies. This is going to be awesome. He's been featured in Time, Business Insider, Entrepreneur, Inc., so many others, and we're so happy to have you. Welcome, Chris. All right, let's dig in. Let's talk about that mindset question, what you're thinking before you get in the room. And I want to start with you, Jennifer, on this. You have climbed the ranks throughout your career, obviously. Look at where you are. You've advocated for promotions and pay. You're also a manager of a large team, so we know you're negotiating all the time there. Mentally, how do you prepare for a high-stakes conversation?
Thanks. I love the question because I'm not a researcher, I'm not an author, but I've learned through many mistakes over the course of my career that you never wing it when you walk into a high-stakes conversation. Preparation is the best thing you can do to ensure the outcome. And I would really label it in 3 different categories. It's knowing yourself, it's knowing your audience, and it's knowing what you're willing to accept. And so I'll just walk through those really briefly. When I say know yourself, I know what I need to feel comfortable and have the best chance of success. I know that I personally derive my confidence from knowing my facts and feeling confident with that before I walk in. If I'm in a situation where I feel a little less comfortable with the subject matter, when it gets really heated, I tend to back off because I get that little seed of doubt and I don't feel quite as comfortable. And I was thinking, you know, I was just thinking of a funny kind of corollary. Who's seen Old School, the movie Old School? Don't pretend that you haven't seen it. Raise your hands. You've seen
this
it,
This is
right?
a no-shame zone.
I promise I have a point. So do you remember at the end of the movie when Will Ferrell has to do that debate with James Carville, right? And he just blurts out this brilliant response out of nowhere, and this is amazing. That literally never, ever happens in real life. And if you don't have the information in your head before you walk into the room, it is not going to magically appear when you're stressed and anxious and emotions are running high. So know what you need to know. And I don't mean that you have to be an expert, because that's actually the opposite of what you want to do. If you wait until you know everything to engage, you will never engage. So know what you need to know to feel comfortable. Know where you are, know where you want to get, and know what some of those kind of key outcomes are going to look like. Okay? And then knowing your audience. And this is all about understanding the person that you're going to be negotiating with or making that proposal to, and knowing what they value, knowing what their goals are, and knowing how what it is you're trying to affect is going to impact them. Right? And how are you going to maneuver that conversation based on that knowledge to get to something that drives that mutual value? The other part of that I've learned some interesting lessons about along the way is understanding the difference between authority and power. Mm. Okay, and authority usually comes from your title or your position. And you can get stuff done that way. Power is more, if you think about the true definition of power, it's force and speed, right? It's getting something done with velocity and moving that needle. And that in business terms is influence. And I've learned that authority and influence are not the same thing, right? And it's important for two reasons, because you can, as the manager of a team, you can impose your will through your authority, and you can get things done that way. And it's okay. But the best outcomes come when you can influence the outcome, when you can get people there on their own, and you can do it in a way that doesn't feel like you're strong-arming people. So understand where that influence is, if the person you're talking to has it, and if there's other people on the periphery that can influence that person or that outcome too. Okay. And then knowing what you're willing to accept, you know, I think about the guiding principles that I walk into something with. It's a really important thing before you walk in the door. Why is this so important to you? You know, my company pays me to drive business outcomes, not to drive my own personal agenda, right, or my own ego. And so I take some time to really know what those principles are that are so important to me, that are making me entertain this conversation, and making sure I know what those few things are that are non-negotiables to me. And then the path you take to get there can be wide open, and you can understand where to flex, what you can give up that may be of value to that person that helps them get more comfortable with where you're going. And when you're in there and it's heated and you start to feel that, like I have friends in the audience, I hate to lose, I hate to be wrong, right? But when you start to feel that, if you can just remember those guiding principles and the true things that are important, it helps you kind of back that off in a little. Mm-hmm. So.
Great. So know yourself and know your counterpart.
Yeah.
Know what they're thinking, what makes them tick. Chris, I want to turn toward you for this. You have been in all kinds of heated, intense negotiations where communication means everything. I want to talk about an important piece of mindset, which is this like a born skill, or do you see it as more learnable, pliable?
A book that I came across recently called The Talent Code, Daniel Coyle, I think, offers that there's nobody's born anything, and that it's all learned. Other than not being 7 feet tall, we're pretty much along those lines. He argues that people that were child prodigies, they just caught on, they got their 10,000 hours in because they just got interested early. IQ's limited, EQ's not. Negotiation is about EQ, emotional intelligence. Everybody's got the ability once they start trying to build it. So, yeah, I don't think anybody's born anything. I think if you're interested and you're into it, you can become world class if you put in the hours.
Yeah, I think that's great advice. If you're somebody who says, I don't do this, or I stink at this, or, you know, I perspire like crazy as, you know, as I even think about doing it. It's learnable. It's a muscle you can flex and take to the gym and get better at.
And I want, then you give me a thought. I noticed I didn't see before Sean Acker's on the program,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
Did you guys, has he been up yet? Have you guys seen him?
Yes.
A sort of happiness advantage.
Yeah.
You're 31% smarter in a positive frame of mind. So if you say to yourself, I'm good at this, or this is fun for me, it increases the chances that you will be good at it because you're smarter in a positive frame of mind. It's a strategic, tactical advantage.
Makes really good sense. I know one of the things you found, Chris, in the trainings you do is that you feel like women pick up what you teach faster than men. Will you speak to that?
Yeah.
We really want to hear the answer to this.
Is that somehow relevant to the people in this room? All right, so I was the FBI's lead international kidnapping negotiator. I ran our negotiation teams globally and domestically. I was the FBI's lead international kidnapping negotiator. I ran our hostage negotiation teams globally and domestically. So made it a point to never comment on gender when I was with the Bureau because, you know, you get a question from a man, are men better or women? And I'd say, it doesn't make any difference to me. All I need is somebody who's good. So ignored that for a long time and then started teaching at Georgetown and then at USC. And I took you hostage if you came to my class. You had to apply the skills outside of class. I'm not big on simulated negotiations. So we give you a set of skills. You got to apply them outside of class. You got to give us a paper. You're not going to give us a paper unless it went well for you. On a regular basis, anywhere from a third to 25% of the class would be women, no more than a third of the class. If you made me bet as to who I was going to get a paper first from, over half the time it would be a woman. And that was going on for a while before we finally noticed it. And then started seeing women succeeding at this in our classes faster than the men would, pick it up faster. And I think probably got a lot of examples in the book of successes. There's a higher percentage of successes from the women than from men in relative to what the percentage was that we trained. And so then I went back to Tom Strentz. Tom Strentz is the father of hostage negotiation for the FBI. Tom Strentz is a wonderful guy. I'm shocked that he still takes my calls. and a sweetheart of a guy. And I said, Tom, this is what we're seeing. Do you have any opinion on women versus men? And he said, well, I always thought women were better. So emotional intelligence-based negotiation, women pick it up faster, tend to apply it quicker, and are better at it. And we're getting much more into an emotional intelligence-based business world. Emotional intelligence is becoming the coin of the realm, if you will, for success. And I compare it to sort of, it's a quantum leap forward. You know, I don't know if any of you have studied science. If you've heard anything about quantum mechanics and quantum physics, you know that we don't completely understand how that stuff works, but all the best advances are coming from it. And I compare that to where we're going to now with emotional intelligence-based approach to teams, negotiations, interaction, the workplace. And it's being principally disrupted by more and more women bringing it in. So we're on the verge of taking quantum leaps forward because of this, because of the diversity in the world.
So go forth and disrupt with your EQ, okay? I love it. I want to ask you, Lisa, your perspective on this mindset thing before you've ever gotten in the room with the negotiator you're talking to. You negotiate multi-million dollar plans and goals within your organization, but then you also do the one-to-one negotiations with employees. What do you think is really a difference maker when it comes to mindset?
Great question.
So I think that there's a couple of mindsets that I'm always watching for in the larger settings and in the bigger proposals that we're trying to get through, the investment we're trying to seek, the goals that we're trying to drive. I generally see a couple of key things, and I'm not going to cover everything, of course, but you see a mindset of people coming in with competition, right? Most of us probably love competition. and want to win. But there's the folks that just want to win, and they want to win for themselves, and they're going to beat their chests, and they're going to be strutting like a peacock and showing their feathers in the room. And so that's one mindset that you have to be able to recognize quickly when you're coming into a negotiation. The second mindset is around who the collaborators. Who's looking at the win-win? So who's coming in with the mindset of, I have a set of things that I know I need and are probably not negotiable. That's my baseline set of things. But I also want to be able to extract value for the other people in the room. And who's most important and where are those priorities that I can create a win for some of those other people as well that fits into their strategies and their goals along with mine. And so that's the collaborative win-win. It's not backing down and it's not giving everything up, but it's figuring out where your goals at some point meet up and align. Because you all have different things you're trying to accomplish, and you all have different strategies and perceptions and thinking about it. In some of the individual situations, some of the mindsets I see, one, frankly, is around entitlement, where you see folks come in and say, I'm really good at what I do. I've done everything you've asked me to do, and I've earned this promotion, and I've earned this new project. And I don't see any reason why I wouldn't get it. And you have to be prepared for that mindset. And that might not match up to your mindset if you're their manager or their peer, or you're on that project and you don't want them on that project, or whatever the case may be. And then the fourth is around, again, in kind of a smaller situation, you'll get certain folks that may be a thought leader who are willing to check their biases at the door. Who are willing to take that leap of faith and let themselves be convinced by what you have to say. And I do see this pairing up a lot with emotional intelligence and with a lot of thought leaders that are emerging to really think about how they do that, how they can come in and have that presence where they are totally immersing themselves in the education you're trying to give them, the facts that you're bringing in, the homework you've done, and truly listen to that. And even though they know they have biases, even though they know you may have a certain reputation, that they're willing to be convinced. And then it's your job, if you see that mindset, to go after that and do that convincing, having done all of your homework. And I think that if you can at least identify those four types, and there's many more, of course, the identification and then thinking about the strategy for that type of mindset is going to get you that much further in your negotiation because you know what you're dealing with. You've identified it right away. You've developed strategies to tackle that type. And the last thing I would leave you with is there's going to be certain types that get under your skin that you can't stand. And you have to identify what of those mindsets or the type of personality really bothers you and really take the time to work on how you're going to handle that. I know exactly which one sets me off, and that's where I have to find that inner, you know, calmness to say I'm not going to let this type of mindset get to me.
Yeah.
So I'll leave it there.
So true.
Yeah, that's great. I've never heard anyone articulate that point about find the people who are sympathetic to ideas, like who are possibilities people, who may naturally be more open to your idea. I love that. What a great thing to use your EQ, to, you know, your spidey sense to check for, right, and look for. I want to ask one more question of the group on mindset, a free-for-all for anyone who might want to answer. Some of you probably negotiate with people you know well, and other people you may negotiate with, like for a new job, with someone you don't know at all. How do you approach, from a mindset perspective, negotiating when it is someone you know well versus maybe someone you're starting from scratch with?
All right.
He got the look. No.
Yeah, and first of all, something I failed to say earlier, I am just grateful to be sitting up here with these three badasses. right, so there was preparation was mentioned earlier. So as a hostage negotiator, we took a little bit different approach to preparation. This is how I think you take yourself hostage. I had to be prepared to sit down with anybody, something I knew nothing about, and I wasn't going to give anything in. There were no alternatives. So if you're willing to start totally cold, knowing nothing about the other side, and you got no safety net, then a lot of the rest of it gets pretty easy. Because I'm not taking myself hostage by needing to have information coming in or needing to have an alternative. So then you change the negotiation process to an information gathering process and don't expect to settle it in one negotiation. You know, we used to say, if we were going to get a face-to-face at a prison riot or something like that, and our commanders would want to know, what are you guys going to do? We say, we're going to sit down, we're going to hear what they have to say and agree to have another meeting. Mm-hmm. And it'd be like, that's all? Like, yeah. You'd be shocked at how far you could get as soon as you don't start putting barriers on yourself. Mm-hmm. So then what's the prep? The prep is how you engage in a process. And small stakes practice for high stakes results. So if we're going to coach you, if we're going to teach you, we want you practicing in your everyday interactions. So one of the guys that we were coaching one day, his now wife, then fiance, said, you know, I really like talking to you these days. What's going on? And he put his head down and he said, well, I'm in this negotiation course and they're making me do this stuff with everybody in my life. And she went out and bought the book for all of her girlfriends, husbands, and boyfriends. So practice in your everyday life. Empathy, the tactical application of empathy. If terrorists are entitled to it, then so are the people in my personal life.
That's great. I love that advice about if it is kind of a cold lead or someone you don't know well, make it warm. You know, break it into pieces, too. Yeah. That's really brilliant. Yeah. Don't expect to do it all in one meeting. I want to do one more thing since mindset is pretty juicy here. Do you want to add something different?
Well, I was just going to apply it in a business setting where, just to share a personal story, I've had a situation where I had a very good relationship with someone I'd been working with for a very long time and thought that, you know, we have a good relationship, I can just go in and ask them for what I need. And I need something from that person's team. So I'm just going to go in and ask. Mm-hmm. And totally unprepared for the fact that it's like, this is a business ask. This is not, you know, part of a personal relationship. And got totally thrown out of the room pretty much because I was not, I hadn't done my homework. I didn't come in with the facts. I didn't come in with all the reasons why I needed to do it and what the outcomes would be. And even though we were very good friends at work, they pretty much threw me out. And it was a huge lesson learned for me, mm-hmm. That even though you have that relationship, you have to go into that when there's an ask or something you want them to do, you have to go into that with the same way as if it's somebody brand new that you're just meeting. Mm.
That's really cool and kind of counterintuitive, right?
Yes.
That's not necessarily how you think of it out of the gate. I bet you didn't make that mistake twice.
I did not.
One more quick mindset thing. Maybe one of you, if any of you have an opinion on this, is there any unadvice? Is there a don't do when it comes to mindset and you're going into that high stakes, important conversation, like definitely don't do this?
Well, again, don't ever wing it. Just don't ever do that. It's you're going to feel uncomfortable. It's going to be so clear that you have a very thin argument or it's not well thought through. And when I think back on the times that I've failed, it's because I've failed to do one of those things, to prepare and know my facts, to understand where they're coming from, and to know what I'm willing to bend on. So, yeah.
Excellent. I hope this gives you lots of stimulating stuff to think about as you get in the room.
Quick comment.
A quick comment,
I know,
sure.
That I don't make quick comments, but this will be true. Never be so sure of what you want that you wouldn't take something better.
That's right.
Yeah. Never be so sure of what you want that you wouldn't take something better. Mm. What does that mean? the more goal-focused you are, the more you have blinders on. Mm-hmm. So the real big don't for us is don't be so focused on what you want that you don't see something better, that you don't spark something better in the conversation.
Right. Tunnel vision, yeah.
That's a great truth bomb right there. There was like a whoa that went over the audience. That expansive thinking, right? That possibilities mindset. All right, well, let's take a little breather from mindset for a minute and talk about tactics. You're in the room. Hopefully you've done the homework. You've thought about you, what's important to you, what's important to them, what's your bottom line, what's your goal. Let's talk about some tactics and get a little brass tacks with this. Chris, I want to start with you on this. I've been dying to ask you this question. What is a black swan? And how does it relate here?
All right. Well, this gets back into never be so sure of what you want. I mean, it's not possible to know everything. It's just not possible. You're going to walk into a negotiation. There's going to be information you're holding to yourself every time. Same as the other side. The black swan is going to be where the overlap is. It's not possible to know the best deal, no matter how smart you are. I don't care if you're Warren Buffett. I don't care if you're Elon Musk. You don't know everything walking in. You got to tease it out of the other side. You develop trust to find out what that is. The black swans are the stuff that's in the middle, where the unknowns overlap. And crazy cool stuff comes out of that.
Love it. It's a perfect image and a powerful one that's going to stick in our minds. Lisa, I have a question for you about some of these tactics as we think about how to come in really ready. What advice can you give on how to best raise your hand to take on a new project, like that really cool, exciting one that's just come in?
Sure. So I think there's a couple of things. First of all, you have to do all the regular business stuff, right? So there's a new project, you have to be able to show the value, you have to be able to articulate the benefits, you have to be able to measure your success and have a clear path to how you're going to have a start and a finish to that project and milestones in between. So there's kind of the basic business things. I think the second piece is you have to elicit people to be have a sense of purpose and excitement about that project. And so it's not just the drill sergeant, I have all my business case things done. You may be competing with other people, you may be competing with other projects. And they're all good, right? And so what's gonna make that project or them want you to work on that project? It's the passion and excitement that might tip you and them feeling like there's a true meaning or purpose for that. The third piece is, to find a champion. And that's where you find somebody that is kind of in that inner circle, or the person whose project it is that you want to be on, or someone that needs to be convinced to let you be on that project, or to push it over the finish line, that there's this champion that has the ear of the person that needs to be convinced, and that they can believe in you and champion support for you to be the person to be put on that project or to make that project go when it's competing against others.
That's great to kind of, again, look for those sympathizers, right? Or those people who are going to get it and want to support you. Anyone here ever worked on a dead end project? Raise your hand. Let's see how many of you. All right, a good, you know, less than I thought, but still. You know, I'm going to ask you the counterpoint, right? Which is not just how do you get staffed on an awesome plum project, but how do you get off one that sucks?
I think you have to check your ego at the door and recognize that there's probably a good lesson to be learned from it, but you have to be really honest. You can't just try and maneuver to just let it die out a slow death. I think those folks that are more successful or the folks that do bring it forward, they are able to be honest about the failure and what they've learned from it, have an exit plan.
don't just come in and say, I want to be off this thing. This thing's dying a slow death. Like, you have to be able to say how you're going to do that. Here's the risks if we exit. Here's how I'm going to mitigate those risks if we exit. Here's the people that might be affected if we exit from this. And really, truly be able to do that. And I think you'll be more successful to be able to get off of that project. And the last piece is, can you forecast, think forward, of if you were to continue on that project that's not thriving, what's it going to look like a month from now? Or what's it going to look like 3 months from now? And the investment that's been made and the resources that have been put on it. And can you show that vision to the person you're trying to convince that you need to get off it and the project needs to die? Because if you can forecast that and show them what that future looks like and how bleak that might be or how it might cost them a lot, then they're going to support stopping that project.
Awesome. Okay, so don't be afraid to paint that future picture. Don't make them only use their imagination. Paint that picture for them. Jennifer, I want to hear from you about tactics and just kind of hear what is the key, do you think, tactically to really getting what you want out of one of these conversations?
Yeah, I'll try to use an example. I would say we've already touched on preparation. I think persistence and flexibility are really important too in these conversations, and I'll tell a sad tale. Back in my career, I remember, I'll never forget, earlier in my career, I was a manager of a small team. Things were going well. I was working really hard for that next step. I was trying to get to the next level, build out, expand my scope, build a bigger team and all that. And I identified a need in the organization. I thought I could clearly add value. I had the best, rock solid justification for why I should be given this opportunity and be promoted and build this new team. And I was successful in convincing my manager of that. So,
Right.
Unfortunately, I didn't realize that my manager was not influential enough to make that happen. And so it was committed to me. It was announced to our broader team. And lo and behold, there were extremely powerful and influential stakeholders who were surrounding this who didn't align to it and were quite frankly pissed off that they hadn't been part of that conversation. And they stopped it. And so that was a very bad day for Jen Mead's ego, right? And I failed to realize the ecosystem around what I was trying to do and what it would actually take to get that done. And I think in that circumstance, it's where the persistence has to come into play. I could have just given up and kept doing what I was doing and waited and tried to figure, maybe some other time. I could have kind of taken my ball and go home and just, quit in a fit of rage and went to find something else, right? Like, how dare you? Or I could, sort of take a step back and dissect what had happened and take another run at it. And that's what I chose to do. And the interesting thing in that whole situation was that those stakeholders were actually really strong supporters of mine. They had championed other advancements for me in the organization. I worked extremely well with them. But I failed to engage them as part of that process. So I spent the next year regrouping and understanding what they really needed, not just what I thought they needed, but what they truly needed, and building that really broad base of support. And ultimately, a year later, I was successful in getting that promotion and building out a new team, but it was different from what I thought it should be. And I learned a really hard lesson in understanding the value to the audience, not the value to me. It's not about what I want, it's about what the business wants and the stakeholders want.
That's awesome advice. Kind of think big and then think bigger, right?
Being flexible, right?
Yeah.
And I think you learn as you evolve, through leadership roles that it's not about you. It's about the people that you're trying to lead along a path.
Mm-hmm. Lisa, I know you had a story, too, about kind of pitching something new that wasn't known. Will you share that?
Sure. So earlier in my career, I had I'd been in a group and had been asked to move to another group. They blew up our group, and I discovered I didn't really like this new job I had. And so I looked around to see where else I wanted to go, and I found where I wanted to go. And so I tried to pitch to move into that organization, and I had figured out over time of starting to work with them what I thought was a great role and was needed by that organization. And, oh, by the way, I'm a great fit for that role. And so you should hire me and put me in that role, because we've been talking about how I want to come join your organization. But so it took some convincing and negotiation, and they finally said, yes, you're right, we need that role, similar to your story. And so, great, they want that role. They realize there's a gap. Well, turns out they didn't want me in that role. And they asked my boss to take that role.
Ouch. Ouch.
Yes, big ouch. And here I really was trying to make a change. I did not like my job. I was not happy. And so again, you know, what do you do in that situation? Persistence and resiliency are so powerful, particularly when you feel most vulnerable. You're not happy with what you're doing. You're trying to make that pivot. Someone buys into that pivot, but, you know, goes to somebody else. Long story short, in 6 months' time, they did actually put me into the role.
Well done.
Lots of tactics
well
to get there.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
One thing I'm reading between the lines with both of these stories is that you didn't kind of internalize that forever. You could have. You could have said, this is a mark of my value. This must mean I'm worth X. And you didn't.
No.
I mean, both of you kept at it. And
right.
I find that incredibly inspiring. We're getting close to our time here. And so I want to ask you a question, Chris, about tactics. If somebody's trying everything they know and they keep getting a no answer in the conversation, right? They're trying everything they can to motivate that other person. Is there anything you think can help them overcome that no and turn it into a yes?
Yeah, you should have asked that question in the first place. No, seriously, but if you don't like the word no, you're asking the wrong questions. Because you're trying to get people to say yes. And people's automatic response to yes is to say no, because yes is a trap. Would you like to make more money? Would you like to have more free time? I mean, yes, this is going to sound really stupid, but it's insane as to how true it is. If it's important to me, I don't try to get people to say yes. Instead of saying, would this work for you? I say, are you against doing this? Most people are in no mode, N-O, they want to say no. Their automatic answer is no. So change your questions. That sounds insanely stupid, and it's insanely effective. Are you against doing this? What's wrong with this? People will always tell you why things don't work, and as a consequence, if you take that approach, what you're left with is what will work.
Right. Mm.
And since yes is almost always a trap, if it's important, we don't bother with it. You'd be shocked at what people are comfortably saying no to. And the first person that really taught me that was a female hostage negotiator that was in charge of our Pittsburgh office negotiation team. She's getting ready to get thrown off the team because she was embarrassing her boss because she was making the office look so good. It was an additional duty. He was jealous. He called her into the office to remove this duty from her. And I never would have had the courage to ask this, because I knew a lot about the word no, but driving for it intentionally. And she looked at him and she said, do you want the FBI to be embarrassed? And that sounds like the worst setup question. I never would have had the guts to say that.
It really does.
But until you know how well it works, and he said no. And he sat back and he did one of these steeple things with his hands, which is what people do when they feel safe and in charge. Mm. And it was an approach of deference. We preach deference. Deference is not submission. So if you don't like the word no, change your questions. It's kind of that simple.
Very cool. And also a little counterintuitive, right? You're trying so hard to get the yes, that's kind of all you think about sometimes. We have just enough time to hear a kind of final takeaway from each of you. You've talked to us about prep and getting in the right mindset, some really important tactical considerations. What do you want tattooed on our brains as it relates to negotiation? And I'll start with you, Jen.
Sure. I've got two quick things. So the first, it sounds silly, but just don't be a jerk. Like, there's no reason to be a jerk. It's, you know, I try to win the war, not the battle, right? So you can win the battle by being a jerk, but good luck when you go back to that well the second time, right? And you want your brand as a leader to be somebody who can open up possibilities for people, not somebody who jams things down people's throats, right? And then the second one, so not so much about negotiation, but, you know, I think a lot of people think about promotions, and I know I've talked about a couple examples. I'm sure it's on a lot of people's brains, but know that a lot of that happens before you even walk in the room, right? And so people think of, oh, I want that promotion, I'm going to ask for that role I see open. A lot of organizations do succession planning and talent planning. I bring my senior leaders into a room, and we talk about who's next up? Who's on the bench? Who do we want to invest in? You know, when that next role comes open, who do we have on the radar? And so if the first time you say something is when that role is open, there's a very good chance you're going to be too late. So early and often, be very vocal about what value you bring, what strengths you have, and where you want to take your career so you can make sure your name is in those conversations. And then when you walk in that room, half of it's already done.
Love it. Lisa, how about you?
So one of the things that stuck with me many, many years ago at a conference like this, someone was talking about Velcro. You know what Velcro is?
Yep.
Velcro is, you know, the loop in thread, and it sticks, right? And it's instead of glue, and it's used everywhere. And it's really hard to unhinge Velcro when it sticks, and because of its great properties. And if you think about yourself and you think about what is your Velcro? What is it that people that think about you? And it's you know, your reputation, of course, but you carry around a certain Velcro throughout your negotiation, throughout your job, at home. You know, you're known as a certain type of person, and that's something that to me gave me a lot of insight thinking about myself and thinking about how others view me and what kind of Velcro I want to have versus what I actually have and how I want to be seen. Because it's really hard to change your Velcro. Once you're in that job or in that company or in wherever you may work, you instantly get that Velcro, and it's really hard to get it undone.
Mm-hmm.
So I would encourage you to think about your Velcro, and if you don't like your Velcro, to change it. Mm-hmm.
Love it. That will stick with me.
No.
I had to do it. Chris, what?
That was, we can stop with that comment. I didn't need to say anything else.
It was a grandpa joke. It was. But Chris, what do you think here? What must we not forget?
Yeah, no, in addition to what these two ladies just said, don't be a jerk. Think about what your Velcro is. But now, then the last part is you can do it.
Yeah.
That's it. You can. You can do it. You're good enough.
That's right. Can we give this fierce panel a round of applause?